From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the author of The Female Eunuch reaches menopause. We talk with writer Germaine Greer about her new book, The Change, Women, Aging, and the Menopause. Also today, hold your tongue. We talk with journalist James Crawford about the movement to make English the official language of the United States. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD set of Cole Porter music from the 1930s. It includes recordings of Porter himself and such singers as Fred Astaire, Ella Fitzgerald, and Mabel Mercer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israel has agreed to work alongside Palestinians from outside the occupied territories in multilateral talks. It means Israel is now prepared to end its boycott of talks on regional economic development and refugees. The agreement to talk with Palestinians from outside the occupied territories is described as a major concession that the former Prime Minister, Yitzhak Shamir, stoutly resisted. John Devitt reports from Jerusalem.
The Israeli Foreign Ministry said they would now participate in all five multilateral working groups, so long as the Palestinians included are not members of either the Palestinian Parliament, the PNC, or from East Jerusalem. The Palestinians would also have to agree not to raise the question of refugees' right to return. The announcement follows the surprise visit to Israel by the Egyptian Foreign Minister Amer Moussa. Diplomatic sources say Mr. Moussa conveyed the impression that the Palestinians would also agree to the terms. There has been no response so far from the Palestinian leadership. While the multilateral talks are a side issue to the all-important bilateral negotiations, reaching a compromise of the sort that's being suggested could act as an important catalyst for wider agreement. For National Public Radio, I'm John Devitt in Jerusalem.
The Bush campaign continued to hammer away at the issue of Bill Clinton's anti-war activities today. The president was in New Orleans to accept the endorsement of a law enforcement group and to celebrate the initialing of the North American Free Trade Agreement. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
While jogging this morning, President Bush promised he'd have more to say about Bill Clinton's anti-war activism, but he left the issue to his handlers today. Last night on the Larry King Live Show, the president had raised questions about Clinton's credibility and patriotism. He urged Clinton to level with the American people about the draft and about his anti-war efforts. Today, campaign spokeswoman Mary Madeline said that Clinton was an obsessive politician who changes his story anytime he thinks it will be unfavorably received by voters. She pointed out that Clinton had given different accounts of his involvement with Vietnam War protests. President Bush is trailing Governor Clinton in the polls. Republican strategists say this line of attack is an attempt to keep the doubts about Clinton's trustworthiness alive. However, opinion surveys show voters are not very interested in the Democrats' draft history or his Vietnam-era activities. In New Orleans, I'm Mara Liasson.
For his part, Bill Clinton dismissed President Bush's attacks on his patriotism as an apparently desperate effort to revive his reelection campaign. Clinton has acknowledged that he took part in an anti-war teach-in and rally when he was in England as a Rhodes Scholar. He said his visit to Moscow consisted of tourist activities. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 24 points to close at 3,176. Advances led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR. The latest report from London says that at least one person was hurt this evening when two car bombs went off in the central part of the city. The police have cordoned off an area near the busy London Bridge rail station, backing up traffic across the city and paralyzing parts of the subway system. The situation was complicated by the fact that the two blasts came more than an hour apart. Police said a telephone warning was called in 10 minutes before the first bomb went off. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but the Irish Republican Army said earlier that it planted the two bombs that exploded yesterday in London's theater district. With the first presidential debate set for this Sunday evening, the commission organizing the event has released the names of journalists who will question the candidates. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The moderator of the first debate, to be held in St. Louis, will be Jim Lehrer of PBS's McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour. The three questioners are Ann Compton of ABC News, John Mashick of the Boston Globe, and freelance journalist Sander Van Oker. This panel was assembled after the Bush and Clinton campaigns exchanged lists of reporters they wanted involved, subject to the other camp's veto, and then presented the debate commission with about a dozen mutually acceptable names to choose from. Although he will take part in the debate, Ross Perot had no input. Several news organizations, including CBS and NBC, objected to giving the candidates a say in the selection process and refused to let their reporters participate. The debates that follow Sundays will use a mixture of formats, including a single moderator, questions from an audience, and another reporter's panel. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
The Senate has passed a bill changing the way federally controlled water is allocated to farmers, urban areas, fish, and wildlife. The measure would limit sales of federally subsidized water to Western farmers while allowing extra supplies for wildlife in cities in California and other areas afflicted by drought. The bill passed the House on Tuesday. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Germaine Greer has always had the reputation for being outrageous. She became a celebrity feminist in 1971 with the publication of her book, The Female Eunuch. She equated the eternal feminine stereotype with characteristics associated with castrati, timidity, delicacy, languor, and preciosity. Recalling that period, journalist Barbara Grizzuti Harrison described Greer as an anarchist, a one-time musician's groupie, a scholar, an authoritarian beauty possessed of no fear and apparently of no inhibitions, a brainy lady who relished sex and said so. Over 20 years and several books later, Greer has come up with a sometimes outrageous analysis of what is often thought of as a delicate subject, menopause. Her new book is called The Change, Women, Aging, and the Menopause. It's part memoir, part history, part social commentary. I asked Greer when she went through menopause.
I don't know how people can give a very clear answer to that. I'm not even sure that I'm through menopause, really, because the climacteric takes from 45 to 55, say. You can start early, you can start late. But the whole phase is a 10-year phase in your life. And the idea of menopause is an event that never occurs. Menopause is the period that doesn't come. And one of the things about actually going through the climacteric is that you may have long periods without seeing menstruation. You might have 3, 4, 5 months, and then it comes back. Sometimes it comes back in spades, and then it goes off again, comes back again. So that if you read family planning literature on the subject of menopause, they say that a woman should continue using her contraception for 2 years after she sees her last period because it's so uncertain.
So you really don't know if you're through it or not?
Well, I'm 53. I haven't menstruated in a long time. I hope I don't menstruate again, but I might.
Why do you hope you don't?
Oh, because that would mean it was all to do again. I quite like the idea that it's done. I've done that.
Uh-huh.
I can move on now.
What had the bigger impact on you psychologically, going through menopause or turning 50? Just in terms of, you know, the psychological impact of what it means to be getting older and so on.
I don't know that I could answer that, because I don't remember 50 being a biggie for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember looking in the mirror and thinking, oh, my God. I can remember more vividly discovering the first wattle, I think it's called, which happened in my mid-40s. I was polishing a mirror top table, and I happened to made the big mistake of looking down and seeing myself from underneath, as it were. And I thought, holy God, what is that? I had a kind of bracket had appeared attaching my chin to my neck, which was quite unnecessary as far as I could see. And I think I'm probably much more worried now about the fact that my damn teeth are falling to pieces because they're going to have to be replaced. I'm going to have a strange mouth, which at 53 I don't want. What else? My eyes, needing your first pair of glasses is a cruncher.
I had my first pair of glasses in kindergarten.
Well, when it becomes in your mid-40s, it's different.
Yeah.
When they say to you, oh, your eyes are wearing out, you can't focus anymore, and you say, but what do you mean? Give me exercises. You know, let me limber my eyes up. And they say, sorry, sister, what's happening is the piece of equipment is wearing out here. And if you use it even more, if you do focusing exercises, it'll wear out even faster. It's sicker focusing.
Menopause means the definite end of childbearing. You've never had children, although I believe you had a couple of abortions, and then later in life you tried to conceive and went through surgery, hoping to
conceive.
Hoping to conceive, yeah.
Well, surgery is not a good way of conceiving.
Well, hoping to get more fertile through the surgery.
Yeah, that's right. More or less, that's right, yes. But you shouldn't read you shouldn't believe everything you read. But sure, I had abortions, and then I had some corrective surgery when I was 40-something. I don't remember how much now.
When you were in your late 40s and now in your early 50s, has this been a time for reflecting on choices pertaining to childbearing, the choice to not have children and then to later in life to try to have children?
No, not really. That's not what happens. And I don't think it should happen to anyone. It is a time for grieving for everyone. Everybody pretends that having children is fulfillment with a capital F. And that you can look back on your children as some sort of triumph. You can put them down on your CV as achievements. In fact, you can't do that. You're not allowed to do that. The only thing as a mother that you will have to put down on your CV are the things that don't work. Your children's problems are much more likely to be laid at your door than their successes. And at the same time as I was trying to have a child, I was pretty well aware that my girlfriends who had growing children were going through all kinds of emotional stresses and strains with those children, that children are a problem in many ways. Their suffering hurts you more than your own suffering. And anybody who doubts that about mothers should just consider the way that women fight for their children's health, for example, that if a woman has a damaged child, she will go to the ends of the earth to get treatment, but she'll barely go to the doctor to get treatment for something that's wrong with her. And the same thing is true of children's problems, that mothers' hearts bleed for their children, and they bleed the more because they can't do anything for them, especially after they're 18. After they're 18, they're not even entitled to know where they are.
In your book, you write about the invisibility of older women. Is this something you're feeling personally? Do you feel different when you walk down the street or step into a restaurant or a party?
I try not to step into too many parties. I don't like them very much. Well, especially as mostly you have to stand howling at somebody you hardly know over a terrible background noise, and they're only paying half their attention because they're looking over your shoulder to see who else is there. Parties I can do without, but I always could. I'm not a party girl. I don't think I ever was. The invisibility thing is terrific when you get used to it. It's hard to get used to it at first. At first, you just can't understand why people seem not to see you when you're standing right in front of them. But then you begin to realize that you are going to be allowed to walk slowly. I spent my life going to places like Rome and sprinting through the streets because if I slowed down, people thought that what I really wanted was to be spoken to, touched, invited out, blah, blah, by them. I can remember going to the Piazza Navona in Rome and having to take crochet work and sit with the old ladies pretending I was one of their daughters in order to be able to look at the space around me, because there were so many men sniffing on all sides. Now, when they stop sniffing, you feel a bit bewildered. And then you begin to realize that you can do whatever you... You can even sit down in a public park and be left alone. And it works two ways. When you go into a restaurant, for example, if you're a younger woman on your own, there can be certain thoughts in the maître d'hôtel's mind. And if you're a middle-aged woman, there are other thoughts. Principally, do you think she'll be able to pay the bill, and is she in her right mind, is what they mainly think. Not has she come in here to pick up a tired and over-emotional businessman.
Let me recreate a scene that you describe in your book. You're sitting at a restaurant in France with a woman friend of yours who's about the same age you are. And you're sitting the two of you and talking, and at a table nearby are two men of about your age, who are dining with two much younger, very attractive women who seem to be hanging on the men's every word. And this, of course, leads you to wonder about the different kind of social meaning of older men and older women. So is this something you've been measuring a lot lately?
Well, actually, it's not me who is terribly upset by this. It's the woman I'm with.
Yeah.
Who would not resign herself to not being the center of men's attention. Would not... absolutely would not resign herself and really thought she might commit suicide. I'm happy to report she has another man in her life, so don't give up hope. If that's what makes you happy, you probably can have it. You have to make certain adjustments, that's all. You have to be happy with what you can get, I suppose. But that's always been the case of women and men. It's always been a case of acceptance. We really cannot go out there and make a set at the man we really want. We have to be wanted. And even though we've protested against this and demanded the right to ring men up and so forth and to make the first move, I don't think we've been able to dictate the men's responses, and they still call the shots. And this is something that I notice very much as a teacher with my students, that the women are much more vulnerable to the men emotionally than the men are to the women. And that's an inequality that we haven't eradicated, in my view.
So what about the inequality of the sexual desirability socially of older men and the sexual undesirability socially of older women? That doesn't bother you?
No, it doesn't bother me because I don't desire them. If I did, it probably would. But if I did desire them, then I could make certain moves. There are certain options available to a middle-aged woman who wants to stay in that game. As far as I'm concerned, if a woman wants to stay in that game and she's prepared to put in all the money and the energy and to be seen to be available, that's fine. I'm interested in the other women who don't want to do that and who are yet given the impression by the media that it is their duty to themselves and the rest of the world to do that. I want to say, phooey, you can do whatever you like. If you want to go around wearing a boiler suit and a crash helmet for the rest of your life, go for it.
Writer Germaine Greer is my guest. Her new book is about menopause. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Germaine Greer, and she's written a new book called The Change, Women, Aging, and the Menopause. Let me read a couple of things that you have to say about sex and older women. You write, "Some women, the lucky ones, I shall argue, lose interest in sex after menopause." You say, "If the sexuality of older women were allowed to define itself, it is possible that we would discover that older women are not overwhelmed with desire for even older men." And you say there's a dark side to the emphasis on continuing sexual activity as a sign of vitality in marriage. So are you making the argument that you think most women during or after menopause really do lose interest in sex, or are you just saying that there's too much pressure on everybody to keep kind of sexuality as a central focus, even if it's not?
Well, first of all, if I say some, I mean some. And I mean, I don't know how many. And I would say that the women who lose interest in sex are the lucky ones, because it would be dreadful to be tormented by unrequited sexual desire till your grave. That seems to me to be great misery. That if you couldn't get laid at 30 or 40 or 45, you're not going to start getting laid at 50. And also, I think quite seriously, bad sex is bad for people. Sex with strangers is suicide. It's self-destruction. Don't do it. Don't be bullied into thinking that if you don't do it, you'll be crazy. I believe if you had bad sex, you will be crazy because it's bad for you. It's a killer.
Are you making, what about women who are married, though, or who are in long-term relationships?
I would say even of them, that if the option is bad sex with the person they love, they should eschew it.
Your book never seems to get around to good sex, though. your book seems to spend a lot more time kind of focusing on a lack of desire and unsatisfactory sex.
All the other books get around to good sex. They make it sound like a duty. They make it sound like cleaning your teeth.
I guess I find this particularly interesting coming from you because you're somebody who first became known for writing about feminism and sexuality, and you have really had your share of sexual encounters over the years. You co-founded and co-edited a kind of radical erotic magazine that you would pose nude for. So, I mean, you're certainly no stranger to sexuality. And you're making the argument that...
I could still be a stranger to sexuality, even if all those things were true. But however, I would agree with you. I am not a stranger to sexuality.
Right. But let me ask you something kind of forward here, and feel free to not answer this if it's too personal. Have you found that the menopause affected you sexually, that you felt any less of a sexual drive?
Yes, absolutely. But I don't. It's not true that I feel none.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't seem to feel it. It doesn't seem to me to be important anymore.
And you resent a culture that says it should be.
I resent a culture that says if you're not tortured by physical desire, then you're not sane or normal.
What particularly do you think is giving you this message that, you know, to be healthy, you really ought to be sexual?
Well, it's everywhere. I mean, if you think of it in terms of menopause literature, all menopause literature has a chapter on how to remain sexually active. No, very little menopause literature, except mine, has a chapter that says how to exult in the fact that you are no longer so concerned about sexual activity. I mean, we're all pretending that people didn't spend a lot of their time looking for Mr. Goodbar, and that Mr. Goodbar didn't do them a lot of damage. And the fact is that I now, looking back, I'm amazed at the amount of time I put into my sexual relationships. I am astonished at the number of days that were ruined, perfectly serviceable, wonderful, productive days that were ruined because I was waiting for a phone call. I'm really irritated about that. I want all that time back. I can't have the time back, so I'm going to make sure that I don't spend another minute of my life wondering if the man I met, talked to, blah, blah, is going to call me, or, even more tormenting, am I going to call him? It may happen that I'm going to go around a corner, and there he will be, the love of my life. And to tell you the truth, I dread it. I absolutely dread it. It would be a disaster for me.
But you know, you're not just talking about sex here. You're talking about a kind of relationship.
Well, I always was, wasn't I? I mean, I've never had sex without a relationship.
Right, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, the drive to have somebody who you love and who loves you will, you know, probably linger on long past a physiological sexual drive.
No, you're misunderstanding me.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter about having a drive to have somebody love you. The chances are that if you are out there hunting, that you won't find anybody, because what you are projecting is need, 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 and people will love you for your fullness, for your poise, for your balance, for your entirety, not for your inadequacy, not for your need for them to justify your life. I mean, that's the crowning irony, isn't it? And that's why I think it's probably going to happen. Just because for the first time in my life I don't need it anymore, that's when I'm probably going to get it.
Okay.
That's the double whammy. That's what happens.
You read in your book that there's no accepted style for the older woman, no way of saying through dress and demeanor, I am my age, respect it. What would you like to see? I mean, it is true that certainly in America, women of all ages are kind of dressing about the same, you know.
Especially in New York. Well, everybody's wearing these tiny little black skirts with black stockings. You see these little old leggies pounding along the street. It's exposed to the upper thigh. I'm talking about, this starts much before menopause, I may say. Our society doesn't want women to look maternal, let alone grand maternal. You're not allowed to spread sideways. You're not allowed to have hips. There are other ways of dressing which are voluminous. If you think, for example, of the Sudan. In the Sudan, women are meant to be ample and velvety and spreading and large and soft, with their wonderful hairstyle that they have of crinkled hair worn very close to the head. And then they wear an enormous floating sheer white veil. And they look fabulous. They look like galleons in full sail. I mean, compared to them, the sort of painted middle-class New York woman looks like a kind of cockroach.
How are you dealing with wrinkles on your face? Are you obsessing about them? Do they bother you?
I'm wearing them is what I'm doing.
Yeah, well... Are you know, there's the kind of person who stands in the mirror and every time there's a new wrinkle goes, oh, no, oh, no. So what's your attitude about it?
Well, it's not anything you can do about it. I mean, you don't have to pay your dermatologist $500 to be told that your wrinkles cannot be removed by any kind of medication or cosmetic application. They can be relocated by a facelift, but even a facelift won't take them away. They'll still be there. You'll just be a lot poorer with your wrinkles in a slightly different place. It doesn't bother me. It surprises me a bit, because it seems to me, the way it works is that you can look at your face for years and years and it seems much the same. Then it starts to change.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes the way children grow. You know how children grow in fits and spurts? 1 week their arms are too long, and the next week their legs are too long, their arms have nearly caught up, and so on. You don't actually grow uniformly, and you don't age uniformly either. So that you'll go through a few months where your face seems to collapse practically. And you just, every time you look in the mirror, you think, who is that? Oh, it's I. And it's probably true to say that when you're asleep, when you dream your face as an unchangeable thing. You think of your face as unchangeable, like a passport photograph. And every time you look in the mirror, it's got this kind of overlay of strangeness, novelty.
Your face is in your dreams? So you're dreaming like a movie then, where you're a character and you're not in yourself?
Oh, you can do all of that in your dreams and then some.
Let me quote you. You write, "The older woman's love is not love of herself, nor of herself mirrored in a lover's eyes. It is a feeling of tenderness so still and deep and warm that it gilds every grass blade and blesses every fly." A little much, maybe?
How old are you?
42. Wait, let me do the math. I'll be 42 soon.
Okay. Well, the thing is that it does sound preposterous. I know it sounds preposterous. I wouldn't have believed it myself at 42. I had no idea that this feeling existed. But I can tell you, since I began to describe it, I get letters from women all the time, quite often quite severe letters saying, well, you see, we could have told you. I am 65 years old. The past 15 years of my life have been the happiest. And I could have told you all of this. There's nothing new about any of it. But you wouldn't have believed me. And now you know. So welcome to the club. And I've had that letter probably more often than any other letter. And sometimes the ladies are 80 and sometimes they're 75. But I think for all that they would equal all the other letters I've had in response to the change.
So when you add it all up, it sounds like what, you're feeling more liberated than anything else by having gone through the change?
Yes, and happier than I've ever been before, which sounds like something you might say to, you know, a sort of schlock People magazine or something like that. But I am happy, not in the way that I would have been with a lover in the best times of a relationship, maybe, but happy the way, and not even happy the way I was when I won my scholarships, when I got my degrees, and, you know, when I began to be successful. It's a different kind of happiness, and it's accessible to everybody. Another way of describing it would be to say that it's a state of grace, which means something to Catholics. But it doesn't come from God, at least not in my cosmology, because I don't believe in God. It comes from awareness of your own spiritual power, of your spiritual resources, that you are not your body, that there is something stronger and more enduring and more creative than your body, which is, I suppose, your soul.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, my pleasure.
Germaine Greer is the author of the new book, The Change: Women, Aging, and the Menopause. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. There's a movement in America to make English the official language. Some say this is an honest attempt to keep us from becoming so divided that we can't even understand each other. Others say it is a mean-spirited reaction against today's immigrant population. Coming up, we talk about the English-only movement with journalist James Crawford, author of the new book, Hold Your Tongue. Also, Cole Porter songs from the 1930s. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD set called You're the Top. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Governor Bill Clinton said today that he felt sorry for President Bush, who last night on a TV talk show questioned Clinton's patriotism. Clinton said the president was desperate to question a trip that Clinton took as a student to Moscow in 1969 and his role in anti-war demonstrations while attending Oxford. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Last night, President Bush attempted to lump together Governor Clinton's alleged avoidance of the draft, his acknowledged participation in anti-war demonstrations, and a trip he took to the Soviet Union as a student. Mr. Bush said he saw a pattern. Meanwhile, other campaign officials without evidence have suggested Governor Clinton met with the KGB. I can surmise anything I want until he denies it, says Congressman Robert Dornan, a Bush campaign co-chairman. Governor Clinton laughed off the KGB rumors days ago. Today, however, he said he felt sorry for the president. Here we are on our way to a debate about the great issues facing the country, and he descends to that level, he said. His campaign adviser, George Stephanopoulos, was more direct. He said the Bush campaign was resorting to McCarthyite tactics. It kind of makes your stomach turn, he said, but it makes you believe your poll numbers. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
Libertarian presidential contender Andre Marou made a campaign stop in St. Louis today, the site of the first presidential debate this Sunday night. Andrea Murray of member station KWMU reports.
Andre Marou says that although he meets all the criteria for inclusion in the debates, he hasn't been asked to participate. Marou says he's being excluded by the two major political parties in an ongoing effort to discredit the Libertarian Party.
Prior to 1988, the League of Women Voters ran the debates. In early 1988, we talked to the League of Women Voters, and they tentatively agreed verbally to have us in the debates. The Democrat and Republican parties found out about this, and within a month created the Presidential Debate Commission for the express purpose of excluding us, and they did.
Marou will hold his own debate with New Alliance Party candidate Lenora Fulani on October 15th in Richmond, where Bill Clinton, George Bush, and Ross Perot are holding their second debate later that day. For National Public Radio, I'm Andrea Murray in St. Louis.
In Washington, Congress has approved and sent on to the White House a major energy bill that the president has indicated he will sign. The plan calls for energy conservation and support for alternative energy sources. The bill had been held up in the Senate over objections from Nevada senators that the measure would force people in their state to accept weaker health standards for a proposed nuclear waste site. The bill is the first major effort to change energy policy since the 1970s. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 24 points to close at 3,176.03 on volume of more than 204 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney says the U.S. will keep 37,000 troops in South Korea until it's known for sure that North Korea is not trying to build a nuclear weapon. Cheney is charged that North Korea has what he termed an aggressive program to develop nuclear weapons. He spoke after 2 days of meetings at the Pentagon with South Korean officials. A second phase pullout of U.S. troops had been slated for the first of next year. Already, some 7,000 military personnel have left South Korea, leaving some 37,000 still there. In Angola, that nation's president says results of last week's multi-party elections will be announced soon. He also asked to meet with former rebel leader Jonas Savimbi, who has threatened renewed civil war if the results are released. NPR's Suni Khalid reports from Luanda.
The head of Angola's army, General Antonio Ndalu, met today with former rebel leader Jonas Savimbi in an effort to avert civil war. Savimbi left Luanda Wednesday for the Angolan provincial capital, Luambo. Today, sources said Savimbi assured the government he would not restart Angola's 16-year civil war if the National Election Council, or CNE, stepped up its investigation of his charges of electoral fraud. The CNE has so far rejected all allegations of voting irregularities. According to the latest poll results, Savimbi appears to have lost to Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos. Meanwhile, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Edward Perkins, will head a Security Council delegation that is slated to arrive in Angola on Saturday to help mediate the dispute. I'm Suni Khalid, Luanda, Angola.
Officials have announced a tentative agreement was reached this morning between U.S. Air and striking machinist. A union official is calling on members to ratify this agreement, which he says includes job protection. A spokesman for the airline says that goals were achieved on cutting short and long-term expenses. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Many Americans fear our country is starting to resemble the Tower of Babel story, where people couldn't work together because they spoke different languages and couldn't communicate. That is why some businesses are implementing English-only policies, and some counties and states have made English their official language. What does our language controversy have to say about American attitudes toward immigrants today? My guest is James Crawford, author of the new book Hold Your Tongue, Bilingualism and the Politics of English Only. He's also the author of Bilingual Education and the editor of the anthology Language Loyalties. He's the former editor of Education Week. America has always been a nation of immigrants. I asked Crawford why he thinks English only has become an issue today.
Up until a generation ago, 85% of the immigrants to the United States had come from Europe. Well, in the 1980s, 85% were coming from the Third World, from, in particular, Asia and Latin America. And so we're seeing a lot more cultures and a lot more languages being spoken here. And so people often draw the conclusion that, immigrants just aren't learning English the way they used to. In fact, that's really not the case, though. It's funny, around the turn of the century, we had a similar phenomenon when we had a lot of diversity at that time, coming mostly from Eastern and Southern Europe. And the same charges were made against immigrants in those days, that they were just not measuring up in terms of learning English compared to the good old immigrants who had come a couple of generations earlier.
Where are official English amendments big issues today? And which parts of the country is this being debated right now?
Well, it's being debated really all over the country, especially, of course, in areas where there are large language minority populations. That's true especially in the Sun Belt, in places like Florida, California, Arizona, Colorado, and so forth. But it's been a hot issue just about everywhere. In the 1980s, all states in the Union, except for two, considered official English measures in the state legislature or at the ballot box. And 17 of these measures passed at the state level.
Well, what do most of the official English amendments actually legislate?
They're varied. Some of them are simple one-liners saying English is the official language of this state, and it leaves the legislature and the courts leaves it up to the legislature and the courts to figure out what that means. In some cases, however, it's very explicit in terms of prohibiting the use of other languages. My feeling is there's no real reason to declare English the official language other than to restrict the use of other languages. Official English essentially is the same as English only. That's the core idea. For example, in Arizona, in 1988, the voters passed a measure which said, quote, "This state shall act in English and no other language," period. And there were very narrow exceptions to this. It applied to basically everything the state did, including the language that state employees could speak and the performance of their official duties. It was so restrictive, they thought they were going to have to close down their tourism office in Taiwan because it hardly made sense to operate that in English only. Fortunately, this English-only amendment was struck down by a federal judge as a violation of the First Amendment. However, the case is on appeal, and it could well go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
What are your problems with English-only amendments?
Well, my problems with English-only amendments is that they are very mean-spirited. If this movement was simply about helping people learn English, there would be no controversy at all. Unfortunately, that's not what it's about. It's about punishing people who don't speak English, excluding them, canceling programs which are designed to help immigrants adjust to this country.
You know what everybody always wants to know? Why is it that the immigrants who came to this country in the earlier part of the century just went to English-only schools and they learned English and they were able to get jobs speaking English and to assimilate into America, and now that's not good enough. Now people want, you know, bilingual education. They want kind of special classes and so on. How do you answer that?
I know that is the conventional wisdom, but in researching my book, I looked a lot at the history of this issue in the United States, and I found that that's just a myth. The fact is we've had a lot of different languages spoken here since the earliest days. You know, during the colonial period, we had a substantial German-American population. Throughout the 19th century, we had bilingual education in many states. There were a dozen states during that time that specifically authorized bilingual education in the public schools. And it went on unofficially in lots of other places, not only in German, but in Spanish, French, Norwegian, even Cherokee. The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma had a system of bilingual schools where they actually achieved higher rates of literacy in English than their white neighbors in Texas and Arkansas. So the idea that earlier immigrants never had government services in their language is simply a myth. There was, however, around the turn of the century, a kind of reaction to the cultural diversity and language diversity at that time. And there was a period known as the Americanization campaign, when there was an attempt to coerce people to learn English as quickly as possible. This also coincided with the World War I period, when there was all of a sudden a lot of paranoia about German Americans, since we were at war with Germany. And there were a lot of laws passed restricting the use of the German language in most public context, especially in the schools. And it was during this time that bilingual education was basically wiped out in the United States.
My guest is James Crawford, author of the new book Hold Your Tongue, Bilingualism and the Politics of English Only. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Crawford, who writes about language controversies in America. The image in America is no longer the image of the melting pot. It's the image of multiculturalism, where people come in to the country and they become Americans, but they also preserve something of their own ethnic background. Is there a justified concern that people are less interested in assimilating now and therefore less interested in learning English, and that could be very divisive for the country?
Well, there's certainly a concern, but I think it's not at all justified. Simply the fact that people would like to preserve their native language doesn't mean that they're not learning English. The fact is that immigrants today, the objective evidence shows, are learning English faster than ever before. Around the turn of the century, there was sort of a typical three-generation pattern of becoming dominant in English. The first generation would come and learn survival skills in English, but basically would stick with a native language. Their children would go to school and gradually would become bilingual. And then the third generation would grow up dominant in English. Well, today we are approaching a two-generation pattern of language shift from the native language to English. That means, for example, that among the children of Hispanic immigrants, 7 out of 10 become English speakers for all practical purposes, which means that many of them are actually losing their native language, which is unfortunate. As I mentioned, I think it's essential that we develop these skills in other languages.
Do you think at the root of a lot of the English-only movement is a frustration when you're trying to communicate to somebody in English and they don't speak English? And that frustration sometimes happens when you take a taxi and the taxi driver doesn't know English, or when you call a store and the person who's representing the store doesn't speak English, or you go into a shop and the shop owner doesn't speak English. The statement you often hear is that I felt like I was in a foreign country, but I was in my own country.
Well, exactly. I think that's more what's going on here. It's not just a frustration about an inability to communicate, but it's a feeling of sort of losing power, of losing control in one's community, and having a new group coming in, making claims, and doing things differently. And it's very much a turf issue to some extent. And the idea, I think, behind the English language amendment for some people is the idea, well, let's pass a law saying, really, who's in charge here? You know, whose language is the legitimate language and whose is not? I think that's an unfortunate reaction, however. It's an intolerant kind of reaction. And it doesn't look at the consequences that creates for people who are coming here and are trying to adjust, especially the idea of cutting off bilingual services that people need to survive in this country. I mean, there are a lot of very essential services. 911 operators, for example. In my hometown of Washington, D.C., recently, we had an incident where a Spanish-speaking woman, a Central American refugee, was being raped. She called 911 three times, and because she was unable to speak in English, the operator hung up on her. There was no bilingual operator on duty.
There was a case in 1984 where two African-American women weren't hired to clean an office building because they didn't speak Spanish. They only spoke English. And this story was used as an example of how people who are American and don't have skills with a second language can be deprived of jobs and therefore the way they see it discriminated against, you know, in their own country, for speaking nothing but their own language.
Exactly. That issue was latched onto by all the English-only proponents as if it was sort of the tip of the iceberg. But in fact, it was really, I think, an isolated case. It was the only such complaint ever received by the Dade County Fair Employment and Housing Board. There is a real problem, I think, in terms of bilingual job requirements, which are legitimate in a community where you have people speaking a lot of monolingual English speakers and a lot of monolingual Spanish speakers in Miami. Bilingualism is an important job skill, even in fairly lowly types of service jobs. That was not the case with this, you know, office cleaning job, where there was absolutely no reason to require people to speak Spanish except for the convenience of the contractor. And in fact, there were a number of Cuban organizations which supported those African American women. It's saying that they had been unjustly treated.
What are the hot spots now in the language controversy in the United States?
Well, bilingual education is always a hot issue. Bilingual education is the largest example of a program where we use other languages to essentially help people adjust to this society. And it's especially important for children because starting school, if they fall behind a couple of years, oftentimes kids never catch up, and their life chances really depend on school performance at an early age. So bilingual education was reintroduced, in the late 1960s after a long period of the sink or swim treatment, where children were essentially thrown into regular classrooms without any special help, and they inevitably fell behind. A lot of them, unfortunately, were then labeled as slow learners, and they were overage in their grade, and by the time they got to junior high school, they were starting to drop out in large numbers. So bilingual education was introduced as a more efficient way to help children learn English by making it a more gradual transition, by allowing kids to continue studying in their native language and other subjects so they would not fall behind in those subjects. Another advantage to bilingual education is that developing the native language skills tends to translate into developed skills in a second language. It's easier to learn a second language if you have a firm grasp of your first language. This is especially true in the case of reading, where It's very difficult to learn to read in a language you don't really understand. So if you learn to read, you learn those decoding skills, which is a big intellectual event in the life of a child, as adults tend to forget. If you learn those skills in your native language, they're going to transfer to the second language. Once you can read, you can read. And that holds true not only for languages that are relatively similar, such as Spanish and English, but also between languages like English and Japanese or English and Korean.
James Crawford is the author of Hold Your Tongue, Bilingualism and the Politics of English Only. It's published by Addison Wesley. This is Fresh Air. Lynn Neary is with us. Lynn, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, Terry, tonight we'll have a report on how voters are feeling about charges that Bill Clinton's draft record should raise some questions about his ability to be an effective president. And NPR's Ann Garrels will have a report on the fact that U.S. officials are becoming increasingly concerned about the safety of nuclear power plants in the former Soviet Union. And then Linda Wertheimer will be talking with a music writer and a disc jockey about the undying popularity of ABBA. Believe it or not, there is a renewed interest in the music of this 70s pop group, and we'll be hearing about that tonight.
I'm glad you're on that story, Lynn. Those stories and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is a big Cole Porter fan. To celebrate Porter's centennial, Koch International Classics, in conjunction with the Indiana Historical Society and the Historical Sound Recordings Collection at Yale, recently released a lavish three-disc box set called You're the Top, Cole Porter in the 1930s. Here's Lloyd's review.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now God knows anything goes. Good offers too, who once knew better words, now only use four letter words, writing prose, anything goes. If driving fast cars you like.
A century after he was born, and more than half a century after his first song hit swept America, Cole Porter is still sung and still listened to. His music has never lost its insinuating appeal. His lyrics have lost none of their freshness or sharpness. All those topical lists in songs like You're the Top and Let's Do It present the most vivid picture of their time. But I think it's that very specificity that makes them so universal, which may be why they've survived so many different approaches. This recent collection is most extraordinary for its variety of performers and styles. Represented here are not only the worlds of the legitimate theater and film, the stars Porter wrote for, but also the great figures from the world of jazz and pop music who took over and helped spread the word. So we not only get Fred Astaire, Ethel Merman, Mary Martin, Gertrude Lawrence, and even James Stewart, who introduced Easy to Love in the 1936 film Born to Dance, but there's also Ella Fitzgerald, Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong, Artie Shaw, Art Tatum, Benny Goodman, and the late Sylvia Sims. There are even a couple of awful but fascinating souped-up versions by opera singers. It's great that the producers allow us to hear some of the songs in radically different incarnations.
Night and day, you are the one. Only you beneath the moon and under the sun. Whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling, where you are, I think of you. Night and day.
Night and day.
I'm especially glad that this set includes some of Porter's own favorite performers, like jazz singer Lee Wiley and cabaret star Mabel Mercer, who was one of the century's greatest interpreters of pop and theater lyrics. Here she is in a delicious, seldom-heard verse from It's Do Lovely.
The knot is tied and so we take a few hours off to eat wedding cake. It's delightful, it's delicious, it's do lovely. It feels fine to be a bride. How's the groom? Why, he's slightly fried. It's delightful, it's delicious, it's do lovely. To the pop of champagne, off we hop in our plush little plane till a bright light through the darkness cozily calls Niagara Falls. All's well, my love, our day's complete. What a beautiful bridal suite. It's dreamy, it's drowsy, it's the reverie, it's the rhapsody, it's the regal, it's the royal, it's the Ritz, it's the lovely. We settle down as man.
Porter is often dismissed or admired as a rich escapist. But I think underlying everything he wrote is an awareness of exactly what he wanted to escape from. Listen to his poetic, autobiographical lament about the loneliness of wealth down in the depths on the 90th floor. In its original and definitive 1936 version by Ethel Merman, it has an almost tragic grandeur. Listening to these songs from the 1930s, I'm impressed by how contemporary Porter's celebrations of diversity and irreverence and his depression cynicism seem right now. What could be more timely than these lines he himself sings from Anything Goes? Just think of those shocks you got and those knocks you got and those blues you got from those news you got. And those pains you got, if any brains you got, from those little radios. Was Porter predicting the Walkman back in 1934?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed You're the Top, Cole Porter in the 1930s, on Koch International Classics. I'm Terry Gross.
The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today, and black's white today, and day's night today, and that gent today, you gave a cent today, once had several chateaus. When folks who still can ride in jitneys find out Vanderbilts and Whitneys lack baby clothes.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Zelda Gilroy. She was brainy and assertive, but all she wanted to do was marry Dobie Gillis. Sheila Kuehl, the actress who played Zelda, now believes her acting career was ended because of rumors she was a lesbian. Today, she's a feminist lawyer who runs a California Women's Law Center. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Releases on CD. That's Compact Discovery, Sunday morning from 6 to 8 on WHYY-FM.